You don't trust him.
No. That's not... I love what we were. I'm just not sure we're that anymore.
I feel like I need to say out loud that your boyfriend is an extremely powerful mutant who could potentially destroy the world if he wanted to. Or if, say, you hurt his feelings real bad.
Hey everybody, welcome to our podcast. I'm Jason.
And I'm Rima.
And this is Legion Cast episode 16. Legion is my favorite show that I'm podcasting on right now. Did you know that?
It is. I think you might have mentioned that.
Do I say it on the podcast? I probably have a bunch of times.
I don't know if you've said it here. I think you've mentioned it elsewhere or
on the other
maybe
podcast.
Offline.
I hate this show.
I hate this show. I wish I was podcasting on that other show.
Legion. You should listen to that. No, well, I just wanted to say it on this podcast because everybody listening, I'm sure you must like the show too. And so, yeah, this is just super cool. It's my favorite. I'm doing Westworld, which is awesome, and Fear, which is uneven, sometimes good, sometimes not. But this show just kicks all kinds of ass. I like it better than Westworld because it's warmer and it has more fun, playfulness to it.
Yeah, it's serious, but yet it has some lightheartedness to it as well.
And creativity.
It's not... I won't say it's not as deep or serious as Westworld. It's just a little bit different.
It's not as heavy, yeah, it's got a different vibe.
Yeah.
And Westworld
does have a lightness to it.
I think I have said this on the podcast, but I think Westworld sometimes tries to be, it's a little pretentious or something. And it tries to be obscure. It feels like sometimes just for the sake of being obscure. Whereas Legion is more like, we're trying to give you a sense of what it's like to be crazy.
It does a very good job.
I know, especially this episode. After I saw this one, I was like, oh shit, I hope Rima knows what that was. Because I have no idea what happened. Then I watched it a second time and I think I got a better idea. Well, let's get into it. So it's our top five highlights for season 2, episode 8, chapter 16. Did you like it?
I did like it. I liked it, but I was a little bit disappointed because it was a little bit slower than what I wanted. I would have liked to have had a little bit more of a quicker pace. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still think it was very beautiful in how it was presented. I mean, we get some great scenery and imagery, some great music, the same as what we always do with every episode. I just wish it had moved a little bit faster.
Someone else online mentioned stalled. That too. One of the listeners. And I didn't even notice that. Maybe if I watched it again with an eye towards that, I would notice. But you're not the only one who thought that. I really liked it. And I'm glad I liked it because I was starting to think that I don't like the episodes that deal with the plot of Farouk versus David. And I only like the ones that are creative tangents. But like David, multiple personalities, David and... you know, going into Sid's brain are my two favorites this season. But this one, I think, was, you could say, plot-centered, right? And I liked it a lot, even though
I agree.
Didn't know what I was watching the first time.
Right, yeah, I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not. I don't know who's crazy. I don't know who's not. But I'm enjoying it. I just wish, and I'm glad that we, as much as I enjoyed the other episodes, I am glad that we kind of got some movement towards the story and towards the plot. I just wish it was just a little bit faster. It was just a little bit slower than what I would have liked. I know it doesn't always have to be action, 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 but it just still felt a little slower than what I would have liked. That's all. But it was a good episode. I liked it.
I mean, I think the plot of this season is pretty simple. David and Farouk are both looking for Farouk's body, so they had to kind of stretch that over at first 10 episodes and now 11. And so my guess, who knows, man? Actually, I don't know for sure, but they might not even find it for another couple episodes, you know? Or they might find it and then have some epilogue stuff. I'm not sure. Did you ever watch American Horror Story Asylum? You did, right?
I did. Yes.
And one thing I really liked about that I hope this isn't too spoilery. It's real general about the structure, but it was, you know, however many episodes, say 13 episode season. And the story kind of wrapped up in episode 10 or 11. And then there were like one or two or three more episodes after that, that were just like what would happen after the story finished, almost like an epilogue, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was really weird because we don't usually get that, but it was kind of cool. That was my favorite season of American Horror Story, if anybody cares.
I like Murder House. Asylum was good too. They've all been pretty good.
I still have to watch that last one.
Yeah, I do too. I'm behind.
All right. Well, anyway, God, I'm going on a tangent. Sorry. What's your number five for Legion?
Number five. I'm just going to start off like where we started in the episode, which I feel like I'm trending towards that a lot, is David and Sydney. I like that we finally got them together again. I always really enjoy their scenes together. I think they always have great dialogue. I think it's always really sweet when we get them together. But, you know, they're talking about, you know, she's asking him questions. You know, what do we do now? She's asking him about her future self. Well, have you thought about asking me? And he just kind of looks at her and he's like, you know, future me. And she kind of is suspicious of him, wondering why he doesn't want to talk to her future self. She's like, are we fighting? You know, I thought that was kind of a cute little scene.
It was like before. Every time she asks about future Sid, I feel like it's in part because she really thinks she could be a resource, but it's also to kind of check and see what's going on between her and David.
Maybe. Yeah, I didn't think about that. Maybe she's still kind of suspicious because in the last episode, she's kind of like, should I be jealous? Yeah, so now she's kind of like, well, so yeah, maybe she is just doing a check. But I just thought the scene was really, really sweet. And she finds out that he's not wanting to now help, because she's like, you could just see with her facial expressions, and she's just kind of without him even saying anything, and he's just looking at her, and she's like, okay, so we're not helping him.
Right. Like, he didn't even answer.
Yeah. And she's just like, you know, when are you going to tell me all of this? Because he has all of this going on in his head, and he's not really communicating with her at all about what's happening between him and future Sid. He's not communicating that he's changed his mind about helping Farouk.
He's messing up in this relationship.
He's not doing great. He's not communicating very well. He's holding back.
Yeah.
And she knows he's holding back, but she doesn't push it. So, I don't know. I just really like that whole scene between them. I think that anytime you get them on scene, they're just really sweet together. And I think that they have a really great chemistry between them. So, I just really enjoyed that whole scene.
Yeah. I wonder what the two actors, I bet you they're friends and everything. And they're really friendly because it seems like they have good chemistry.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I always hope for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of surprising sometimes you find out two actors hated each other or something. Most of the time, I think the actors like each other. But anyways, that's my number five is David and Sid. And I think lately we've been getting a lot of signs that Sid is having doubts about David.
Mm-hmm.
Like the honeymoon period might be over. And here she's telling Clark in the hospital, it was so romantic meeting him. I needed that, which almost feels like, oh, you know, I was wrapped up in it back then. And she said, when we escaped into Summerland, it was addictive and intense and sweet. And he's a good person, you know. And then I love how Clark just has this blank look on his face, like, I better not show what I really think here. And then she's like, he tries so hard, which is never a good thing to hear about yourself. I love what we were. I'm just not sure we're that anymore, which, you know, I don't think she's like over him. I just think things are changing. And also he's withholding and she doesn't like that. And so there's a little rockiness.
I think it just shows like how the relationship has evolved. I think she misses, like you said, they're kind of out of that honeymoon period and they're just evolving in their relationship.
And there's definitely potential for them to just move into the next phase, which is totally solid, but it's, I think it's a little rocky right now. I mean, she's, I love the part where she's smacking, I'm on your side, asshole.
Quit leaving me so out. Funny. You know, she's like, let me in and tell me.
And when she talked to Clark, she said, you know, or he's like, I got to tell you, I this must be said out loud that your boyfriend is a incredibly powerful mutant that could destroy the world if you're in a bad mood or something, you know? And you could tell that's kind of what's going on in his mind the whole time. It's such a fun little scene between them two, because mm-hmm. she's this woman who's having a little trouble in her relationships, confiding in this guy. And he's this government operative who's really scared that this out of control mutant is going to destroy the earth, and knows that Sid has influence with him. So he's trying to, you know, that's an inroad to trying to solve this situation. Those are two such different perspectives, but he's trying very gently to engage her on the level where she's at in her relationship, even going so far as to talk about his ex-boyfriend that kept trying to get away from him by skydiving, you know, showing a little vulnerability so she'll open up. I just thought it was really cute scene.
Right. But I had trouble with that scene, though, whenever Clark's telling her, like, you have to walk around eggshells. Don't upset David, because he could destroy the world if he, like, if, you know, he, if you decide to, like, end the relationship, or if you reject him or something. That I think that put a lot of pressure on her, you know, in that way. I didn't think that was very fair.
It's probably not, but I think it's true. Like, it made me yeah. really start to get into Clark's perspective a little more. Like, if I knew that there was this mutant who had a history of mental problems and had enough power to destroy the world, and I don't even know if Clark knows this, but there's a future where apparently he did, that you'd be like, oh my God, I gotta figure out some way to prevent anything bad from happening. And so I feel for him.
I feel for him, because you could tell, like, from season one how he acted around David. He was very, you know, he definitely interrogated him,
suspicious, and kind of pushed him a little bit,
but he was still kind of like trying to keep him calm, because he knew he could just go off and completely destroy everyone and everything around him.
And we forget, because Dan Stevens is so charming and good at being affable, that so it's easy to just be like, don't mess with this guy, he's a great guy, and screw anybody. But it's like, yeah, there's potential there for some badness. But anyways, mm-hmm. so yeah, you're right. Clark puts a lot of pressure on her, but and then she goes, I'm gonna go get him. And he's like, is it because of what I just said, that he could destroy the world? And she goes, no, it's because love is what we have to save if we're gonna save the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that reflects what she'd said a few episodes ago. Love isn't going to save us. It's what we have to save. And so that makes me think, okay, maybe she's feeling some doubt, and she's even scared of what he'll do. She says to Clark that he lies, and that maybe he doesn't know what's real and what's not. And, you know, I don't, even after she said, you know, about saving the world, she's like, I'm not sure that's what he's going to do. So I think she's mm-hmm. afraid. But what her goal is to save it all. So she hasn't given up on their relationship at all, but it's sketchy right now, and she wants to try and save it. But even then, when they are together and they go through that time loop where they see themselves mm-hmm. dead, and to me that was sort of like a little perspective, like not necessarily a wake-up call, but just like you see your new boyfriend or girlfriend, and all of a sudden there you are, dead. And you think about the future, and he says, we're going to go find a little farm and settle down and grow old. And she goes, and die. And that's how all relationships end. So she's getting a little pessimistic there. But anyway, I think her ultimate goal is that she hopes that they can make it work. Right? She's still in love with him.
She's still in love with him. She still has hope, I think, for their relationship. I think that she's just probably, like you said, just doubtful, because she knows that he's withholding. He's not telling her everything. He leaves her a note mm-hmm. under the door, you know, gonna go kill the monster. And I really like that scene, because she's sitting in her room and that tea kettle is going. And that is like that tea kettle that she played that game with herself. When she, you know, she was telling David that while he was away for that whole year, that's the game that she played with herself, when she'd hold her breath, see if she could hold her breath for as long as until the tea kettle went off. So I like that she opened that note and read it, and that's when the tea kettle went off.
Yeah. And that was about him hoping he would return within that time, right? From
yes.
where he,
yes.
that orb that he was in.
Yes. So I really like that little throwback that we had. And I like how she was like, you know, not again. I'm not doing this again. I'm not going to sit here and let you just go off again, which granted, it wasn't really by his choice when he was like scooped into that orb, how whatever you want to call it, transported into that orb and was gone for a year. That wasn't necessarily his choice to be gone, but she still had to deal with it, whether it was his choice or not. And, you know, this time she's like, nope, not happening again. You're not going off and you're not leaving me. You know, we see how it's affected Melanie with Oliver, you know, being gone and how what it's done to her. And she made that choice to go after him. And I really like that. So that definitely tells me that she has not given up. She's, yeah, you know, going to say, I'm on your side and I'm here and we're going to do this together.
Right. Which is, yeah, that's where she's been. And mm-hmm. I like that Clark said his ex lover kept jumping out of planes to get away from him, and she jumps out of a plane to get closer to David.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of a fun way for her to pop into the scene.
I love that scene. That was super fun. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it's cool. Very superhero-y.
Yes.
Okay, what's your number four?
My number four is Potonomy in the Mainframe. Mm-hmm. Just kind of short and sweet, but I really like the visuals. I like seeing him kind of interacting. It seems that he's not quite, like he's inside of it, but he's not quite a part of it. He's able to like poke around and see different things similar to the way that Fukuyomi does in scrolling from like thing to thing and like, you know, how Fukuyomi just seems to like spy. I think of it like spying. Like he can just scroll through and spy on different scenes, and Potonomy's able to tap into that. And he finds the monk left behind, because we saw the monk, oh gosh, many, many episodes ago. I can't even remember which episode it was, but several episodes back, whenever he's all wired into the mainframe, he's kind of hacking into Fukuyomi's. I think of the mainframe and Fukuyomi being one and the same.
Yeah, and the Vermilion. They're all like networked in there together.
Right, like they're all the same thing. They're all hooked up together, and we saw the monk all hooked up with the wires and stuff, and how he was hacking into the mainframe, and there's still a piece of him left. So Potonomy, you know, communicates with him and is able to find out where Farouk's body is, and I love that he was able to like sort of hack into the Vermilion. Mm. That was so cool.
It's me. Now he's Potonomy. He goes, that's not funny. No, it's really me.
David's, like, when Dan Stevens is doing, I mean, he's got great facial expressions because yeah. He sits in front of him.
Yeah, he's like, can I help you?
What do you want? Hello? Because he waits so long to talk, like, because yeah. You can tell Potonomy really has to put forth some effort to really say something. Yeah. And when he's silent, David's just like,
And those what? Vermilion, you know, are so weird anyway, so it's like
they are, they're very off-putting. Yeah. Anyway, you know, David's just probably trying to enjoy his waffles. Yeah. You know, with the little
that's great. And that so, that is a regular scene, or you know, place for things to happen, this little weird waffle place.
I know, it's just so off-putting. Having the food on those little boats, belts, that are just going yeah. by as you're sitting there eating your dinner, your lunch, whatever it is that you're having. And so I really like that whole scene. I really like Potonomy, how he's trying to communicate to David, and his voice starts to change. It sounds like that female voice that you're familiar with the Vermilion, but then it starts to change and starts to sound more like Potonomy. I just really like that whole scene, and I find that just mm-hmm. really interesting. And I'm hoping that Potonomy's not completely gone. You yeah. know, I don't know how that's going to play a part and what it's going to look like, you know, as we move forward. But I hope that there's still something for him moving forward. But I like know. That whole thing.
Yeah, I like the Vermilion was like, or Potonomy's like, yeah, his body's in the It's like, where is it?
it's like it starts to shut down. It yeah, like starts no. to slump over, and you're like, no.
Okay, yeah. Well, speaking of the my number four is La Désolée, which, if that's what they're saying, is French for desolate, which kind of describes a desert.
Very much.
Bleak, empty, deserted. And this place is interesting. It's almost like one of these psychic landscapes, because buildings move around and time is weird. And Farouk says time and space is relative here. Sometimes by the hour, it's part of the trick to keep me from myself. So I assume that means that the monks either created this weirdness, or they at least knew that this place had these weird properties. So they thought it would be a good hiding place. That's what I thought.
looked pretty convincing to me.
And so David teleports there after, I think he found it by going into this tank that lets him project his consciousness outward. And he just said, La de Soleil, and it showed him where it was. So he teleported there, but he couldn't teleport directly to the monastery. And I think
because he doesn't know the secret.
Yeah, he doesn't know the secret. And it's just the properties of this place. It's engineered to make it really hard to find the monastery. So that means he has a long walk. And then I was like, well, how did Farouk find it? But on second watch, he found this woman who had been there when after his fight with Professor X and had helped transport his body there, right? I think.
Yeah, she was like the driver of the, was it a hearse, whatever,
yeah,
that was transporting his body to that place. So, yeah.
In exchange for being able to have this like eternal pleasant dream or something,
mm-hmm,
she told him. And I'm like, well, why didn't he ask her a long time ago? That's what I wondered.
Because he didn't know who she was. He didn't find out who she was. Sid, future Sid, told him.
Oh, really?
The little bird.
Oh. Oh.
He said a little bird told me.
Oh, shit. Okay, so they are working together.
I don't know what that means, but it showed as he's having that conversation with her, and I don't know that we were given her name, of this older woman that is the chauffeur. It shows future Sid whispering into Farouk's ear.
Okay.
I'm like,
got it.
What is going on here?
That makes sense, because future Sid has always wanted to help Farouk find his body. So
that's true.
Totally,
because she needs him
to defeat David.
Prevent. Yes.
Mm-hmm. She's bad.
And he called her little bird, and then it reminds me of those darn delusion chicks things that we got. It's like,
I don't know.
Does that mean something?
It might be. You never know.
I don't know, but it makes me crazy. Can't just be saying little bird. You know, that's what
right
you call your little spies.
Careful,
little
writers.
Bird. Yeah.
Okay, what's your three?
My number three is our flashback of young Fukuyami. So I was really excited that we finally got a little bit of insight into what happened to Fukuyami. He was so mysterious.
Fukuyama.
I mean, the dude wears a basket on his head. We did get to see his face, his real face, not that freaky delusional bird face that everyone kept seeing because they were freaking out, but we got to see his real face, and he was just like this sad old man who looked like he had been living this life of torture. He had scars on his face. He was wearing that halo thing around his head. Looked awful, but it was interesting to see how, you know, it looks like he was recruited by the government to keep their secrets, and apparently he has these healing powers, which reminds me of like Wolverine. We know Wolverine has this, you know, he was able to heal from that procedure, you know, that gave him his, where they coated his skeleton in that, I don't remember the name of that steel, but you know what I'm talking about.
Adamantium.
Yes. So it sounds like that, you know, they picked him because he was able to recuperate from that. He was able to heal and put this thing in his brain and basically make him the machine that bleeds.
Yeah. So that he wouldn't be able to have his mind read so that he could be the keeper of secrets.
Right. And then he somehow, out of all of that, because we don't see anything past that, we just see where he's being read by this nurse who's reading him a story, and he's in the hospital after the procedure and he's all hooked up with those wires. We don't see how he got from there to where he's at now, but somehow that led to him being the head of this Division 3, which I guess because he knows all of these secrets, he's, like you said, the secret keeper.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still a government operation. Yeah, so apparently it's part of his career trajectory.
Mm-hmm. I know, it's interesting.
What?
Just all of that, and like how does that move forward? I mean, it's interesting that we got to see it, but there's got to be a reason that it was shown to us, and it makes me wonder if maybe Patanami will somehow become leader and take over for Fukuyami.
Ooh, maybe, yeah.
Now that he's in the mainframe, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they can use that gun to give Patanami his, change somebody else's body back into Patanami's or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What happened to Patanami's body?
He was when that
creature
delusion chick thing crawled out of him, killed
so,
him.
I don't know if we saw what they did with the corpse, but if they can get some DNA. Anyways.
He's still fresh.
That's part. My number three is Fukuyama too. And Fukuyama is reading, young Fukuyama is reading Sigmund Freud's Das Unheimlich, which is the uncanny, which is a adjective that is used to describe the X-Men. The Uncanny X-Men was the name of the comic for a long time.
Yes, but I remember.
I tried to just read up on what it's an essay that Freud wrote, and it's complicated, but it's about things that arouse dread and creeping horror and about fear of the unfamiliar. But I think it's about how those things are us. They're about repressed things that are inside us, but they're hidden and rejected by us, and then they're externalized to the outside world. And then so it kind of goes in with this whole narcissism thing, which I'll talk about later, that whole John Hamm segment.
Yes.
But the guy said to him, everything is unheimlich that ought to have remained secret and hidden but has come to light. So it's about this guy, the guy that was recruiting him, trying to make him afraid and talking about scary things that play on Fukuyama's fears, telepaths who can steal your secrets, and, you know, going on and on about that. So the plan is to create a mind that can't be read. So I guess the point of all that is that Fukuyama's origin is tied in with just a reaction to fears. And I think the theme of this episode is sometimes these fears or problems can come because we don't.
There's no understanding.
These weird psychological, concepts. Yeah. They're actually fear of self in a weird way, but we're not conscious of that. But anyways, I don't understand really why they showed that either, unless we're going to learn more about him later. But I found it interesting nonetheless.
It was interesting. I didn't even pay any attention to what he was reading, but I know I kind of looked up a little bit about what the nurse was. I don't remember everything, but what the nurse was reading at his bedside.
The creepy grandma.
Yeah,
the creepy grandma. Yeah, that was, what was that? Phantom Toll Booth.
Yes.
That's a children's book. Sounds like it's a cool book about learning and thinking for yourself. I think the writer was on an episode of... Yeah, I just read today. In fact, I remember, I don't know if this was part of this American Life episode, but he was in the military or something, and he pretended to be a part of this fake news organization called the Navy News something or other, just so he could interview attractive women. And then he gets all these awards for writing this awesome children's book. So, interesting guy. Anyway, what's your number two?
Number two, we've talked a little bit about it already, but that was just that conversation between Clark and Sydney. I really like the dynamic that these two have, and we haven't, I don't think, really had them on scene or like share a scene together, just those two, before, and I thought it was really great. I love Sydney. I'm really enjoying Clark, you know, because first season, I was like, oh, you're a bad guy. You're trying to hurt our friends. But, you know, I like it's now pitchy. That's kind of been flipped a little bit. And now I like him and really enjoy his character and learning about him. And, you know, so it was really interesting, I think, to have these two share a scene together. I thought they had really great chemistry together. And, you know, Sydney was telling Clark that she thinks it's her fault about David, that, you know, she somehow shares like her mother's curse because her mother like had this, I don't know if it was this habit or just what she chose to do in life, was pushing men away. You know, she dated married men. She only had boyfriends. She never got married. So she thinks she's a lot like her mother, who never settled, and that she's the one pushing David away, that maybe it's her fault that he's behaving the way that he is. So I thought that was really interesting. I like how Clark tells her, it's like, it's okay. It's unofficial. This is all girl talk. We're having a conversation. It's off the record. So I just really like how they were just having that conversation and how she was able to kind of open up to him. We've already talked a little bit about how Sydney was reflecting on their relationship and how it was in the beginning with David and how it's not the same anymore.
Yeah.
How Clark kind of worried her a little bit, you know, he's like trying to just warn her, like, you know, if she somehow rejects him, breaks up with him or something, or upsets him, it could make him basically destroy the world. Not too many worries that most girls have to deal with their boyfriends. Yeah. It's usually like, you know, oh, he might slash my tires or something. This guy could destroy the world.
Right. So. I'm not convinced through this whole conversation that I think he's a good guy, But I really feel like he's almost humoring her because he just needs to find his main charge is to try and protect the planet from evil mutants, and or at least dangerous mutants. And he thinks David could be his greatest potential threat. And so I think that looms much bigger in his reality than here's my friend Sid. You know, he probably thinks of her, oh, she's a nice girl and everything, but it's more about protecting the planet than anything else. So as they're sitting there talking about her relationship with David, then he goes, all right, I feel like I need to say out loud that your boyfriend is an extremely powerful mutant who could potentially destroy the world if he wanted to, or if, say, you hurt his feelings real bad. It's like, I'm glad he put it out there. It's like, let's make sure we understand what the stakes are here, you know? And right. It is a lot of pressure, but it's probably better said than unsaid.
Oh, absolutely. And I like that he's not afraid to communicate that, and he's, you know, and he does have to say it out loud, you know, because not everybody can read minds like David. But I do think he does have a sense of duty. He doesn't forget who David is and how powerful that he is. But I do sense he a little bit of truthfulness where he's coming from with Sid. I do feel that he does kind of feel for her. But it does make me wonder, you know, we keep seeing, you know, and this is kind of just a side note that I was thinking about, because I keep seeing Clark staying at Division 3. Like, he's sleeping there and he stays there. And we got to see his family in season one. Like, they devoted a whole episode to his family, you know, him and his family in season one. And so it makes me think, why is he sleeping at Division 3? Where's his family? He even had a child. He has a husband, a child. It's total a side note, but it just made me think as the episode was happening and he snaps out of his sleep from whatever thought bomb that David implanted inside of him. That wakes him up, and I'm like, why is he sleeping there? Why is he not with his family? Why'd they spend so much time on that episode in season one, and then he is where he is? But anyway, side note.
Yeah, I wonder if they just sort of decided not to expand on that part of the story, so it was easier to have him there, or if there's something to it, you know what I mean? I mean, it's pretty significant, yeah, that suddenly he's, like, not with his family.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Well, I've got two more. I've got one that's all about that aside with John Hamm about narcissism. And then I've got another one that's kind of just trying to lay out what the fuck happened in the episode. Which one should I do for my number two?
Well, if you've got it all figured out.
Let's do that one.
Yeah, let's okay. do that.
So at first I was like, I wasn't clear if. It's clear David wants to find the body, but I'm like, is he still helping Farouk? As you said, she knew right away, no. And yeah, just thinking back, he's still mad at Farouk for killing his sister. And he had a fight with future Sid and said, no, I'm not helping you anymore. So I think his goal is to, he says, we just need to find the body fast and finish this thing. He's going to destroy it, right? I think that's his goal. And so then Potonomy, as we talked about, manifests through the Vermilion and tells him where the body is, because he found out from the monk that, I don't know if the monk's full consciousness was stored in there or just a piece of it or what, but anyways, doesn't matter. So then Farouk also finds out where the body is through that woman, and David uses this tank to get the general vicinity of where it is, the desert, and teleports there. But before he does that, there was this montage where he's got these game pieces with the pictures of all the characters on it, right? Remember that?
Yes.
And he's like touching them and disappearing and everything. And the, man, I was like, what the hell? But I really think what that was, because he implanted something in. We saw, like you said, Clark woke up and there was some suggestion. I forget what he said. Find the clock of the long now.
Okay. Long now. Okay.
Yeah.
And was that prong thing, that weird, because we saw a flash
yeah,
of it.
I don't think so. That's
you don't
not
think
a clock.
That's where they're going. Well, it's
maybe,
not a clock,
yeah.
But it's,
that's
I
a
don't
tuning
know.
Fork.
Yes.
So
tuning
yeah.
Fork.
Yeah. It could be. But so I think when he woke up and said that, find the clock of The Long Now. That was right after Sid said, you better have a plan. And so when he was putting all those pieces on the board and imagining his friends in the desert in different strategic positions, I think that was him concocting a plan. And then he was implanting suggestions into everyone so that they would start enacting the plan when the time was right. But through Oliver, they've gotten to Melanie because she says, it's done, she's ours. Oliver says that. And Farouk's like, mine, she's mine. But anyways, so Melanie conked Clark on the head and stopped the plan in its tracks. So David, David's at least part of his plan is thwarted there. So that's what I think was happening there. So they're out in the desert. Sid finds him using her compass, her David compass, and she's on his side. And then they're just trying to get to the body. And Farouk, Oliver said to Farouk, what about David? And Farouk said, he's like a day behind us. And he, like you said, he's not going to find it unless he figures out the secret, which we don't know what that is anyway. And then at the very end, we see Farouk getting very close to the body saying, my love, I'm about to be with you. And so I think he's just...
weird.
That was narcissistic, which I'm going to get into on my next point. But so he's about to get to the body. David's a day behind. It doesn't have the secret, and his plan is messed up. And so that's pretty much my summary of what happened in this episode. Does that leave anything big out? I don't know what the tuning fork was all about. I have to go back and watch that again.
Well, because they kept flashing to different things, like you know, as David, you mentioned David is moving his people, like he put Lenny in a certain spot, he put Clark in a certain spot, and he was kind of moving people. It was kind of like moving chess pieces on a chessboard and placing those thought bombs. And like you said, for them to go off as strategic moments, for them to wake up, and like, you know, with Lenny, she gets out and, you know, the door just happens to open and she gets out and she's off on the motorcycle, which was amazing, by the way.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I was wondering who let Lenny out, and now I realize that David did, because that's part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she gets out, and then when it happens to Clark, he, like you mentioned, he gets taken out by Melanie. But Melanie makes me question, I know that Oliver said, she's mine, like it's done, she's mine. Farouk says, she's ours. And so is she really working under both Farouk, or is it Oliver? Because Oliver reached out to her psychically a couple of episodes ago. I think it was the episode whenever they had taken Amy and merged Lenny into Amy with that whole episode. And Oliver tells Farouk, I'm going to kill you, you know. And as he's driving down the road and then wherever they're headed, I guess to Amy's house to find her, you can hear him reach out to Melanie and whisper to Melanie, and you see just a flash of Melanie. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's Oliver that's reaching out to her and he's making Farouk think it's under his influence, or if it really is Farouk through Oliver.
My guess is that Oliver has a bond with Melanie, so, and Farouk knows that. So Farouk is using Oliver to get to Melanie, and maybe there's some amount of Oliver in there that can emote and whatever, but basically he's under Farouk's thumb. So I think what we saw Melanie do was exactly what Farouk wanted her to do.
Well, I feel like, I don't know, I know that he is under his control, but I'm wondering if he's able to somehow break free of that. I mean, Oliver isn't as strong as David, but he is a strong mutant himself.
Yeah, I don't think we saw that this episode, but maybe he will be able to at some point. I could be wrong. But I think
I don't know either.
What we saw was Clark was starting to do what David wanted, and then Melanie conked him out, and Oliver said to Farouk, she's ours. So we saw Melanie mess up David's plan, and then we saw Oliver confirm to Farouk that she's ours. So it just seemed like she's being used by Farouk and Oliver to mess up David's plan.
Right, whether it's under Farouk or it's Oliver, she's still messing with David's plans. Yeah. Maybe Oliver doesn't even know. I mean, he doesn't, I don't think, really know what David... He knows that he's following them, but he doesn't know his plan. So even if he was working independently from Farouk, communicating with Melanie through that psychic link
that
they have...
He's doing Farouk's bidding.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know what the hell to believe.
Okay, what's your number one?
That was my number one, was all of that, was finding Farouk. Just a side note, and it's probably just better to save for notes, but just something that I have placed in here was, I love that they're in that rickshaw and they're going through the desert.
You guys running. And,
Oliver has a martini in his hand.
Yeah, and he's dressed in a suit. It reminded me a little bit of Burning Man. I don't know if everyone knows what that is, but it's out in the Nevada desert, and you see people dressed in suits with martinis out there, too. But,
yeah, well, he would certainly fit in there, because I just love, I mean, Oliver, because he's always like in the first episode of the season, and him and Lenny are lying in the pool, and he's like, oh, my drink's empty, and all of a sudden it just magically it fills up, and he's got another drink, and he just always has that martini in his hand, and I just love it. It's classic Oliver. Love Jemaine Clement. I hate that we haven't got to see a little bit more of him this season, because I think he's brilliant.
Yeah. And it was funny to see that poor guy running his ass off, and they're just sitting there relaxing.
Where did he come from?
And it fits with Farouk having a slave. And I was looking up, it's called a running rickshaw, and I learned that in recent times the use of human-powered rickshaws has been discouraged or outlawed in many countries due to concern for the welfare of the rickshaw workers. But not in Farouk's world.
Not in this... this weird place that they're in where time doesn't matter. I think the guy was even barefoot. Poor guy. Didn't even have any shoes.
I guess he's only really having to carry the weight of Oliver, because I think Farouk
that's
is a
true.
Psychic
Farouk,
projection.
That's true. He's not a physical body. So I guess it's just Oliver. I think you covered everything that I would have covered in my number one. We've said it all.
Okay. Well, mine is about the little aside with John Hamm. And
yes.
I was reading this AV Club article about the episode, and I laughed at the first paragraph. It says, this was a terrific episode of Legion, an exciting jailbreak, a mindfuck of a desert journey, and some intriguingly elusive telepathic trickery all came into play. Unfortunately, then it stopped dead in its tracks for a hoary after-school special about the danger of cell phones. It may be time to retire John Hamm's monologues.
You know, I have to just... slightly, as much as I love John Hamm and think I've really enjoyed the little commentaries and features that we've gotten, but this one just seemed a little disconnected. I don't know if it will somehow, because I know we still have a couple more episodes to go. We still have three more.
Yeah.
But I think this one took me out of it a little bit. It just took me out.
I guess, you know, I was a little tired when I watched this the first time, so I wasn't able to focus, and it all felt very jarring to me. I loved it, but I was like, game pieces all of a sudden and time going backwards. And so that just was another crazy thing. Like, you know, I mean, this show I think can get away with jarring. I get it too, though, especially it did kind of divert from the story. But anyway, I still like them. And I really liked this one because, A, it brought in the allegory of the cave, which I had mentioned a few episodes back when they were in the like igloo inside Sid's mind. But it's all about narcissism, the idea that people don't matter, their feelings, their needs, focusing on self and aggrandizing self and not seeing others, or seeing others as a tool for our own flattery rather than fully fleshed out human beings with their own perspective and feelings, and how technology can kind of enable that, because where it's easy to just restrict yourself to your own little bubble where everyone else is, especially on like social media, is a tool for your own flattery. I mean, this is a cynical view, but I think that's kind of what they were getting at, where if you're staring into your phone, that's not the real world, and you're not going to actually feel connected to people, maybe. I mean, there's definitely examples where you are, but like the whole thing of narcissism came about because it's a myth. Narcissus fell in love with his own reflection, and then he couldn't bear to leave it, so he stared at it until he died. So,
yep.
And I think Farouk saying, I'm here, my love, is he's like the biggest narcissist on the show, and he thinks of everyone else as tools for his own advancement, and not, you know, doesn't have empathy or see them as real people. But I think there's a hint that David could become that too. I mean,
yes,
if he's going around and implanting these suggestions or orders basically into people's minds without their permission, and he's moving them around a game board, he's using them too as tools and objects for his own.
I totally agree. I do think that narrative lesson that we had is both about the Shadow King and David's perception of the world. because Farouk, we know, manipulates those around him, and he uses people as tools, and right. he sees them as shadows and thinks that they're, and just doesn't think of them as real. And then David, I think, does it too when he hatches his plan.
Yeah. And even just withholding from Sid and not letting her in. I mean, yeah. He's not as much like that as Farouk, but sometimes he's close and he maybe is heading more in that direction. So there's just this ominous, like, foreshadowing of him becoming this horrible villain, I would say. And then at the episode opened up with a quote: to create fear, hold up a mirror, by the Mego monk, or it's a Mego monk adage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of falls in with this narcissism and also this Freud book that I mentioned earlier about the uncanny, where sometimes our fears are just reflections of something that's inside of us projected outwards onto other people.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really seeing what's really out there. You're just, it's all like this psychological fucked up thing. that's yeah. Way I can explain it.
What you said.
So any other notes?
Notes. I really liked, we had those, I like how they do the split screens. This show, I like how they always have these different directors from, you know, different shows, and they kind of put in their own spin on the show. And I really liked the split screens that they had during a lot of these scenes, especially like when we had David and Sid out in the desert, mm-hmm. and Farouk and Oliver. It reminded me of a comic book, the panels yeah, on a comic book. So yeah. I loved that so much.
It made it more exciting and interesting, just walking across the desert.
It did. And as much as what I was kind of sitting here wishing half the time, going, okay, can we please have a little less walking in the desert? Can we please just move this along a little bit? Because I know I mentioned I was a little unsatisfied with the pacing. At the same time, it was still kind of beautiful to kind of see what was happening. You know, you would see, you know, Farouk and Oliver. You would see Sydney and David. And it was like a comic book. So yeah. I really love.
I don't know if that was intentional. Cool, yeah, I think it was, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was beautiful.
They could have just separated the with lines, but they had thick lines with white, I think, which looks mm-hmm. more like the paint panels of a comic book.
Yeah, I agree. I think we pretty much covered everything else as far as like favorite lines and talking about the narrative lesson during this one. As much as I always enjoy, I did enjoy, I just think I don't like how it went on to, because I liked the whole part about the allegory of the cave. I do like that, and I thought that was really interesting. I just, when it carried on into the whole, you know, like lesson about the whole cell phone thing, I was just like, okay, I'm kind of
a little like preachy.
It was a little preachy, yeah. So I was just kind of over it, but I still enjoyed it.
It doesn't totally fit in either with the allegory. The cave is about, I think it's really, because it's by Plato, who's a philosopher, and it's like, unless you're seeking wisdom and truth, then you're not seeing the real world. You're just seeing shadows. And mm-hmm. Basically it's saying philosophers are the coolest thing ever. And it was a little bit of a stretch to relate that to the subject of the rest of it. But anyway.
Right. I like the first part, but that's all of my notes.
It reminded me of, I don't know if I've said this on this podcast, but I was one of the first people ever to see an iPhone back in 2006. Yeah, came out in 2007, but I worked at Apple and I knew right away, man, this thing is the best thing Apple's ever done. It blows away any cell phone that's out there right now because they all sucked. And I loved it. And now when I look around and see everybody staring into their phones, it's almost like a sci-fi movie where we're all drones sometimes. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a little scary.
It is, you know, a little scary.
You go
scary.
Outside and they're just...
Sometimes I just want to smack phones out of people's hands. Like I was walking my dogs in a park that's close to me, and I'm just walking my dogs and it's a beautiful day. Sun is shining. Beautiful afternoon, and I see a couple of people. I don't know what relationship they had or anything, but these two people sitting at a picnic table, and instead of like talking to each other or just like looking out and enjoying the beautiful scenery of the park, they both have their like faces in their phones, and I'm just like, get off your phone, people, and enjoy the beauty around you, or talk to each other, relate to each other. Instead, they got their noses down in their phones, and that's fine. I mean, my phone's in my hand all the time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm guilty of that too.
Yeah. But so just enjoy, like take 20 minutes and enjoy the beauty around you. Connect with the person that's with you.
Yes, absolutely. That's our message for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stop listening to this podcast and talk to somebody. Jesus.
Well, listen to our podcast while you're walking and enjoying the beauty around you.
Yeah. Yeah. Share your earbud with that girl.
Right.
Across the way.
Share the magic that is the Legion cast.
So I got a couple notes. The Minotaur showed up at the end, which is usually related to Melanie. I have no clue what it is, but I feel like the Minotaur is about a creature in the middle of a maze that you have to defeat before you can escape the maze. And so maybe that's Melanie needs is a metaphor for where she's at.
You don't think it's like a manifestation of Farouk? Because we know if what you think is true, that it's really Farouk, not Oliver, that's reaching out to her, it could be some sort of manifestation of Farouk.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there's so many manifestations of the Shadow King throughout this. So I don't know. I mean, right now I feel like they're just teasing us with this and we really aren't supposed to know what it is.
Well,
that's what I'm going to tell myself.
It's haunting my dreams. I'll tell you that. I don't like that damn thing.
And then the last thing is I got this comment from that AV Club article. I hope the guy or girl doesn't mind if I read it, but I thought it was interesting. It says the white world, which is the space that we see whenever John Hamm's giving us one of his lessons.
Yes.
Is literally a blank canvas upon which to project anything that they want. I know that simple logic would indicate that John Hamm is just the narrator and the writers of the show are waxing philosophic for our entertainment, but there are enough clues to speculate that Farouk is speaking to the audience. His goal to teach us how his powers can be used to manipulate the world, but really how his abilities allow him to prey on the bad aspects of our psyches. In other words, we could just as easily be seeing monologues about how positive perception can create a peaceful and fair world, but who has the motive to tell that, this dark side of the story? So he's saying that he thinks John Hamm is actually another manifestation of the Shadow King.
Hmm. That's an interesting perspective I haven't heard before, because I read a lot of that too, and that I think is something I haven't yet heard.
I think it would be cool if John Hamm did come into the story and not just be, you know,
it would be super cool.
Yeah, and be real and be an actual character or something like that.
Yes.
I don't think that's going to happen, but I would love it if it did somehow.
Same.
All right, let's take a little break. There is more to come. Stay with us. Okay, we're back. It's time for the news.
Okay, so just one item this week from denofgeek.com. So this might interest some folks, because I know I'm a huge fan of the music from this show. So if you are as well. So the man responsible for the furious sound and music of Legion is, as we all know, Jeff Russo. So now his original work for Legion is getting appropriately...
That.
You didn't know that? I've said that like a million times. You don't listen to me. he's getting appropriately recognized and released by Lakeshore Records with Legion Season 2 original television soundtrack. The digital release features the original Season 2 music composed by Jeff Russo and will be available through digital retailers on May 25th.
Cool. I wonder if that means they'll do the songs that he and, you know, the pop songs that he sang with or that Noah Hawley was on.
Yes, like
the covers.
The covers that they did. That's what it didn't say that exactly. It didn't have like a list of what they're releasing in this article. That's just a snippet. But what I read, it didn't say, you know, here's what's going to be released.
Either
they
way, it'd be
teased
cool.
It will be super cool for sure. So I'm interested in that. I'm
Me
definitely
too.
Gonna check it out. But yeah, that's all we got for the news today.
Oh, cool. Okay, let's get into some listener feedback. I'll do the first one. Steve Brown says, Sid, how can a building move? David, I don't know. Now he makes that statement? I don't know what he means by that. Like, I guess, I don't know why that surprised Steve. Anyway, he goes, more reality bending. I forgot that David can teleport. Was there a time loop when they went into the tent? Was there a time loop when they went into the tent? No, I'm just kidding.
I think, I don't know. I felt a little bit like when David, when she says, how can a building move? And David's like, I don't know. It just you know, was kind of like, thank you for acknowledging the weirdness that happens.
Yeah, no, we don't either.
That we don't know either.
But to them, the uncanny, the experience of the uncanny is more common, so they can just kind of let that roll off. Whereas if we saw a building move, like the Bank of America suddenly was on another block right in front of our eyes, I think we'd have to go home and curl up in the corner or something.
Mm-hmm. What is happening?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I'd take it as well. The next one is from Terry. Is it Amon?
Sure.
Hi, it's Terry from Video Fezzy. Hope this gets to you guys in time. I had lots of thoughts about Chapter 16, but mainly I reject this ending. The creepy Minotaur is Melanie's thing, and we haven't seen her since Season 1. I don't think you're mistaken about that. And I mean for realsies. Her wandering out of her room after, oh hey, about a year of sucking blue, sufficiently lucid enough to fell a trained and wary warrior, I think we're going to need more than just a shot of her eavesdropping on Clark and Sid, then popping out of her room, surprise, and cracking Clark on the noggin. Basically, just from Oliver texting her from the astral plane or something. That felt a little too written in, like, oh, right, we should really have Melanie do something. In the lead up to the showdown, I love the way they've organized the story. I really do not know for sure who to root for. Keep up the good work, you guys. We have seen Melanie a little bit.
Saw her a little. I kind of agree. I mean, I don't know if he's being a little, like, snarky or if literal, but we did see her earlier this season, but not much. So your point still stands that all of a sudden it feels out of left field. But I've been wanting to see more of her, and I watched the preview for next week's episode, and it looks like she's in it more, and it's her and Oliver a little bit. So I'm excited to see. I wanted her to come back into it more, so I'm happy for this.
I am too. I think she's not utilized enough because we did see a lot of her. I thought she was great in Season 1 as much as what we saw her. And I really hate that she's just, you know, sucking on that elephant in her room in a drug-induced haze.
Right.
Creeped out by a Minotaur.
Next, Alana Stevens says, Chapter 12, Blue-Eyed Lenny asked for liquid paper to get high. Chapter 13, David is sniffing liquid paper to get high.
Yes, he was. That was not lost on me.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
I got to try that.
Brian Campbell. Hey, guys. Great Excuse podcast. Okay, I wanted to hit... Are you sniffing some liquid paper right now? And you're not sharing? Seriously?
What?
Okay. Future Sid is always the future Sid of a particular timeline. We must remind ourselves, as Chapter 14 so aptly illustrated, there are many different timelines. Future Sid is only despond and about her current timeline is looking at it from her own, possibly selfish perspective.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but her world was destroyed, so I can see her having valid concerns.
A little bit. And she lost an arm somewhere along the way.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're right. There's probably an infinite multitude of Sids based on what we saw in that whole, like, every reality is possible episode. And so I guess you could say, well, that's not my Sid, so I don't care about her. But as far as from her perspective, you could totally understand her wanting to do whatever she could to prevent all that stuff from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Joel from Louisville, Kentucky wrote in about Chapter 15, which was last week, right? Guys, love the podcast. Listening to this week's podcast and some of the things you guys said made me think of a theory, and I wanted your thoughts. We know that the gun Farouk used two episodes ago can change bodies. We assume that David is the threat that ends the world, and Sid believes that Farouk is the person who can stop David. This entire season has been playing with the idea of everything being a mind game. What if future Sid is the one that is delusional and helping Farouk get his body, or my theory, David's body, will help Farouk become the world-ending David she is trying to stop? So her David is not the world ender, but a Shadow King-controlled David who she in fact helped create. I hope this makes sense and would love to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work. It doesn't make sense. Let me read it again.
We're caught in a loop.
So, wait a minute. So, she believes Farouk is the person who can stop David, but she's deluded, and helping Farouk get his body is actually... I mean, I think you think that she's actually trying to help Farouk get his body, but that somehow she's going to accidentally help Farouk become the thing that she's trying to stop by mm-hmm. letting him get into David's body. Yeah, well, I guess the point is that maybe Sid is unknowingly working against herself, future Sid.
Possibly, and she may not even know it.
Yeah, could be. I'm really curious to know what the hell's going to happen with all this.
I don't discount really anyone's theories at this point. It's not like I know what the hell is going on or have any better theories than anyone else. So I'm certainly open to hearing everyone's theories, and I don't discount anyone's. They all make sense to me.
Yeah.
I think anything is possible.
I kind of hope you're right, because that would be kind of a left turn. And I feel like we need something with future Sid to make it so that it's not exactly the way it has seemed. Otherwise, it's a little too straightforward for this show.
Mm-hmm. I agree. We've got three more episodes to find out, hopefully, if we do find out.
They got to resolve this apocalyptic thing, at least, I would hope.
You think so?
Yeah, I think they will. They'll move on to something else for in the hopes of getting a season three. That's still unresolved, by the way. They haven't decided whether to continue this or cancel it.
Yeah, no announcement yet on season three. Hopefully soon. Fingers crossed. Okay, so the next one that we have is from Tom. Says, hi, I recently started listening to your podcast about three episodes back and have enjoyed it. Thank you and kudos for the good work. Hey, thanks, Tom. I'm not well versed in the Legion comics, but know of the multiple personalities with varying powers aspect to his character. While the show has masterfully nodded in this direction with the talking voices, delusions, and overall themes of the human psyche, I wonder if they won't bring things to a more formal plot point in the finale. I don't know exactly where I fall on this theory, but it was fun to think about. With seeing Lenny snapping her fingers and hearing Amy scream, I wonder if we are truly supposed to believe that Amy's consciousness still exists, or if that possibility will be leveraged by the Shadow King against David in their showdown. I think there is something to the idea that the Shadow King might want to inhabit David's physical body. So does that lead to a sacrifice situation for David? Give me your body and I will restore Amy. If this went down, could there be some revelation that it was a lie, mid-fusion, where David begins to fight back, and with both being powerful mutants, his psyche becomes truly fragmented from all of the power jockeying for position in David's body? With the fractured state being the foundation for these other personalities to grow upon, thinking the season ends with people asking David if he is okay after dispelling the Shadow King, and he says, "Who's David?" Does that become the threat of the apocalypse? One of David's personalities has the agenda of domination, so David truly becomes the villain. The Shadow King has been sought because he would be the only one powerful enough to repair David's mind. I don't watch shows for the analytic level of enjoyment, so I'm sure I'm missing something that debunks this. Thought I would throw it out there. What do you guys think of this idea? How do you think this season ends?
Again, I think I kind of get what you're saying. Not totally, but I think that the sacrificial situation could come up. I believe we're going to see more of Amy, mm-hmm. Amy's consciousness. And yeah, that the battle between Farouk and David could end up him being more like in the comics, where he's got multiple personalities that can jockey for a position in his body, and one of them might be a total bad guy. What I hadn't considered is maybe Amy will be one of those personalities inside him. That'd be kind of interesting.
Well, and because in the comics, that's possible, but isn't in the comics, and this might not be so much of a stretch of what you just said, but isn't in the comics, like, if David is around people, because he, in the comics, he's around some type of terrorist event where many people die except for him, and he absorbs a lot of those personalities. Is that true?
I don't remember. That sounds cool.
I think that I read that in the origin of David, because he lost his father in a terrorist attack, and David survived because he's this powerful mutant, right? So he's able to stepfather. Yes, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, Professor X is his real father, but his stepfather died in this terrorist attack, and David survived because he's this all powerful mutant and was able to survive with his powers, but he absorbed a lot of the personalities around him because he was around this event where people died. And even though he wasn't present for Amy's death, I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, there could be some kind of incident where that something like that happens at the end of all of this.
I think what's going to happen at the finale is my brain is going to explode. That's what I predict.
What's cool about David in the comics, I think I've said this before, but he has multiple personalities inside him, and there's one in control at any one time. So it's like the typical sort of cliche about multiple personality disorder where you could get a totally different person in the same body, and he can hear the other voices inside his head, but there's one who's in control. And so he has some, at least one really vicious personality in there that can just fully take control of his body and do bad things. But he's got other ones, and he's very, you know, fractured. I mean, the show has done a really good job of capturing the erratic and fractured nature of his psyche, especially in the first season. Mm-hmm. But what they haven't done is have this thing where different personalities can come forward and be in charge of his body. And that would be really cool if they did get to that. I hope they do.
I think that they are teasing that just a little bit. I mean, we saw a little bit in season one, at least towards the end of season one, whenever David's having that conversation with his self that had the British accent, which I absolutely loved. And then, of course, that was just so brilliant. I could watch that episode over and over again. And then during this season, we've had multiple episodes where David's having that conversation in his head with himself. And it seems more than just one version of himself. It's his voice and the same voice, and there's no British accent. But there seems to be more than just
different
one.
Different tones,
of,
and they're like, seems like some are less on his side than others. And I think this would be an awesome challenge for Dan Stevens as an actor if he had to play totally different personalities too.
I think that'd be great, and I think he could pull it off, because I think he did a great job in season one when he was playing that other version of himself, that British, when he was allowing his true accent to come out. Mm-hmm. I really love that. And you know, we didn't talk enough about this episode. I felt kind of bad. It was somewhere lost in my notes, talking a little bit about that scene with David and Lenny. I really like that scene. That we didn't talk enough about that, so I feel bad about that.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. And I think that was just another instance, basically, of him implanting a suggestion or something. But it was very cool when she was biting her hair and he saw that was a habit of Amy's, and how much of her is still left in there. Like, he's just missing his sister.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's something we've kind of wondered a little bit, is there any piece of Amy left? Like, was she completely taken out of her body? Is that a complete control that Lenny has, or is there any pieces of her left? And it was just nice how, you know, he kind of goes in one way, but kind of turns on to that big brother version of himself to
I'm not
Lenny.
Gonna let anybody hurt you. And that shows that even though David has some tendencies, maybe narcissistic tendencies, or at least where he's doing things to people without their permission, which isn't cool, he also still is a warm person sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that scene, he seemed to show a lot of empathy for her, and mm-hmm. he does with Sid too.
Yeah, he definitely softened towards Lenny, because we still don't know Lenny. Is she still half vulnerable, half is she working for Farouk? We don't know, kind of thing. And
she's
softens
a
towards
character.
Her. Yeah,
but you can tell she's troubled. I think anyway, she's genuinely troubled.
Yep.
All right, that's our show, episode 16. Thanks for listening, everybody, as usual. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email or send a voice message. We'd love to get a voice message. Who will be brave enough to send one next week to us at legion@podcastica.com?
If you have an accent, you're kind of obligated to send us a voice message. Yeah, I insist.
Even if you don't, you go ahead and do one too.
Fake it. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna know any different. Go ahead and fake an accent. I don't care. I'll believe it.
I'll try.
Good day, mate. All day long. I don't care. You can also find us on the web at facebook.com/legionpod.
And be sure to check out our other shows at podcastica.com. Except this is my favorite one, so you're already on the best one.
Right. Listen to this one first and then get to the other ones on Podcastica.
All right, that's our show.
Thanks for listening. I'm on your side, asshole.